Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back and relax. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Center for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned center for the study of Irish, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. We've an interesting program lined up today, folks, and I hope that you will be able to be with us for the next 59 minutes or so. We're going to kick off by making special mention of an event that's coming up later today. Two events, really, at Glucksman Ireland House NYU. You do still have time, if you're in the Tri-State area, to make it to our Lá Ghaeilge, our Irish Language Day, an immersion day in the Irish language. It gives you an opportunity to discover the beauty of the Irish language in a program designed for learners of all levels, and it's led by Paul Ferris, Hilary Vaxivna, Padraig O'Carroll, who we're going to speak to a little bit later on, and our recent arrival from Ireland, our Fulbright visitor for this year, Shane O'Rourke. This event is going to take place at our location here at 1 Washington Mews from 1 p.m. until 5 p.m. today, Saturday, September 13th, and it's free of charge. We'll have beginners, intermediate, higher up intermediate, and more advanced levels. And so if you have even not one word of Irish, feel free to come in. It's a lovely event, and everyone who comes along always has a great time at it. Now, later this evening, I just want to mention an event that I have mentioned over the last few weeks. We have the pleasure of hosting one of the oldest surviving Blasket Islanders, 93-year-old Mihal O'Corna. He'll be interviewed by our Glucksman Ireland House faculty member, Padraig O'Carroll, who we're going to have a chat to, as I've mentioned, a little bit later on. And he'll talk to Mihal. He'll interview him in Irish, Os Gaeilge. This event this evening at 7 p.m. will be in Irish. So, folks, if you have never had the opportunity to talk to somebody or hear that lovely, beautiful Blasket Island Irish, this is a fantastic opportunity and a unique opportunity. Mihal will be 94 in a few weeks' time. I believe he plans to travel to Ireland to Onadán Bhlascaid, the Great Blasket Centre, that lovely location overlooking the Blasket Islands in County Kerry with his family. He's a sprite man. Hopefully we'll have him on the programme next week to have a chat to us. But I'd really encourage people, if you are in the Tri-State area and you don't have anything going on this evening, please take the opportunity to come down. We'll probably be able to squeeze some last-minute visitors in. So do come along. It starts at 7 p.m. If you're a member of Glucksman Ireland House, it's free of charge. And there's a suggested donation of $10 if you are not already a member. So that's our information on this evening's event. While I have your attention in terms of what's coming up at Glucksman Ireland House, next Thursday, the 18th of September at 7 p.m, we kick off our collaboration with the First Irish Theatre Festival. You'll get a sneak peek at Four Women and a Boat, which is the new play by Jimmy Kerr and Geraldine Hughes. And the reading follows a group of friends in their golden years going on a cruise when their voyage becomes an unexpected journey of love, laughter and tears with one very unexpected shipmate. So that's a nice event to look forward to for any of you interested in theatre and in the impressive works of Jimmy Kerr and Geraldine Hughes. And we're delighted to be collaborating with the First Irish Theatre Festival and with George Heslin on that event. On the matter of things Irish as well, I have mentioned this in recent weeks and I just want to get it on your radar again. On Friday, September 19th, next Friday at 7 p.m, we are hosting a celebration, Seamus Heaney and Dermot Healy, and we will be screening the American premieres of Seamus Heaney Postscript. This documentary film is in Irish and English. Of course, there will be subtitles for the Irish language sections of it. And that will be followed by the wonderful 2012 documentary on the late Dermot Healy, The Writing in the Sky. That event will take place at Cantor's Film Centre, NYU's film location at 36 East 8th Street. For any of these details, feel free to email us at ireland.house@nyu.edu, or during business hours, give us a call on 212-998-3950. Moving on from what's coming up here, I'd like to introduce the programme. First of all, I'd like us to have a chat to Padraig O'Carroll about the events going on at Luxman Ireland House. It's a busy start of the semester for us. These events today kick off the start of our public programming, which will run until the middle of December. And as I've said in the past, if you want any information, just go on our website. That's www.irelandhouse.as, as as in arts and science, .nyu.edu. Following on from our chat with Padraig O'Carroll, we will have a chat to the author of a book that was recently launched. I mentioned it on the programme in recent weeks. We had Dr. Gerard McAtasney, a fine scholar who comes to us by way of Belfast with strong Leitrim connections. He was over last weekend to launch his book, The Dead Buried by the Dying, The Great Famine in Leitrim. It's published by Merrion Press, an imprint of Irish Academic Press, and it's a great opportunity to have a chat to the author and have a listen to what he came up with in this fascinating study of life during the famine in County Leitrim. These localised studies of the famine are so important in terms of expanding our understanding and adding a bit of nuance to our understanding of what occurred in those drastic years of Irish history. So we'll have a talk to Gerard a little bit later in the programme. And then we will finish up with some chat with one of our MA alums, a lady called Kate Feary. Kate is coming in to have a chat about her work in the Archdiocese of New York's archive. She's the archivist with the Archdiocese and is an alum of our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies programme. We're delighted to have Kate coming in to have a chat to us about her research here at Luxman Ireland House when she was a master's student and how that has parlayed into her role in the archivist role for the Archdiocese of New York. An important role, I'm sure all of you will agree. I'm happy to introduce some musical interludes to our programme today, and they come from a very talented musician, Jerry O'Sullivan. Many of you know he is one of New York's finest homegrown Illan pipers, and in recent years he's delved deeply into the O'Farrell collections of piping music published very early in the 19th century. What you'll hear during the programme our pieces and our introductory piece of music comes from Jerry's O'Sullivan Meets O'Farrell, Volume 1. I thought they were lovely snippets to hear of Jerry's absolute brilliance with the Illan pipes in O'Farrell's music. So I'm delighted to have them included in our programme this week. Coincidentally, Jerry has just begun our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies programme, and we're delighted to have people of his calibre in our programme, enriching the experience of other students and ours by his presence. So thank you, Jerry, for your generosity in allowing us use this lovely music from your classic Illan pipe music from the 18th and 19th century. Here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU, today we're officially kicking off the fall 2014 semester of public events programming. And today, September 13th, we have an action-packed day centred very much around the Irish language. We are going to have a chat now with Padraig O'Carroll, Senior Irish Language Lecturer, here with us at Luxman Ireland House, who's going to tell us a little bit more about the Lá Ghaeilge Irish Language Day, which will begin at Luxman Ireland House at 1 p.m. and run until 5 p.m. And he'll also tell us a little bit more about what's on later this evening, starting at 7 p.m. here at Luxman Ireland House, when people will have the opportunity to meet one of the oldest surviving Blasket Islanders, 93-year-old Micheál Ócárna. Pádraig himself will interview him about life on Vlaskaid Moor, the Great Blasket, the evacuation of the Blaskets in 1953, and his recent memoir, From the Great Blasket to America. That event will be in Irish, Oscailge. There is still time, people, to make arrangements and come down to us here at 1 Washington Mews to have this unique opportunity. So, Pádraig a Fádraig, Fáilte agus Gurb Maith. It's great to have the opportunity to hear firsthand what's going on today. Will you tell us a little bit first about the activities between 1 and 5 p.m.?
At 1 o'clock, we'll be starting off with classes at three levels, at beginner's level. Now, you don't need to have any Irish at all for that level. It's really an introductory course. You might learn a few words or a few phrases or a couple of songs. And then there will be an intermediate level, and that is for people who have some Irish, some experience in the past. And then there is also an advanced level. That is for either native speakers or advanced speakers. We will have four different teachers. We will have Hilary Lixivne, Shane O'Rourke, and Paul Ferris will be joining us also. So there will be four different teachers, and we rotate. So you have three different classes if you decide to come. Now, it's all free of charge, and after that we will be looking at a film which was recorded earlier this year at Ireland House, in which Iarla O'Leonard performs Shamno songs and other types of songs. That should be very interesting. And then we'll have a break, and we'll come back at 7 with Micheál Ócárna. And Micheál is a fascinating character. He was born on the Blasket Islands in 1920, moved to Dublin when he was 17, and he worked as a bartender at the famous Davy Burns pub on Grafton Street, or just off Grafton Street. He went to Dublin in the 40s, yes, and then he came to America. Came in 1948, actually. He came on the Queen Mary from Southampton and went to Massachusetts.
To Springfield, where the famous Irish kind of community of Blasket Islanders and Connemara people came together.
Absolutely. A lot of native Irish speakers lived there, and he's the oldest surviving person from the Great Blasket.
Tell me, in terms of preparing to interview somebody of this caliber, in terms of his background and stuff like that, what have you done? What's been the most important thing for you in terms of preparing for meeting this man?
Well, basically, I read the fascinating book, and it is a great social history. Just all the information on how people lived back in the 20s and 30s, and when they were coming to the States, where they came. There's lots of descriptions of the American wake before they left Ireland. And the interesting thing about him was his father had been in America before that, and he moved back to Ireland. Not a lot of people were doing that, but some were. If we go back to a memoir by Mickey McGowan, it started in the 1890s. He was born in Donegal, and then he came to the Gold Rush and ended up in Klondike. But that's a very different time. So it was just after World War II when he came here. Life would have been quite tough back in Ireland, and he went to England briefly. Also would have been even tougher back then during World War II. So a fascinating evening. I'm looking forward to meeting him. I haven't met him yet. You've met him.
So, Pádraig, while I have you, I'd love to ask you a little bit, for those of our listeners who don't know, you grew up in a Gaeltacht area as well yourself. Tell us a little bit about growing up in a Gaeltacht and about your background. Tell people a little bit about Donegal and Gweedore.
Well, I grew up in Gweedore, which is the largest Gaeltacht area in the northwest and one of the largest in the country. And basically, I was 9 or 10 years old before I realized that most of Ireland was English-speaking at that time. And Again, I lived on the coast and a lot of interaction with islanders. And the Great Blasket was deserted in 1953. They didn't start leaving the islands in Donegal until the 1970s. The early and mid-70s.
Which islands would we be talking about now, Paul?
Gola Island, Inishmaan, Inishher, Oi Island, Inishbofinne or Inishbofin. Near Tory Island, of course, Tory Island still has inhabitants. They have about 100 people. But Tory is a relatively big island. And then there's Arranmore Island, which is the most heavily populated island in Ireland, which has about 1,300 people. But it's not far off the coast. Mm-hmm. They do have a ferry.
So would there have been a different style of Irish, say... I did an oral history with Micheál Ócháirne in April of this year. And at least, you know, I mean, you know, Padraig, I wouldn't be as keen a linguist as yourself in terms of the language. But one of the things I did notice was that the Irish he spoke is a little bit slower and clearer than what you'd get even inside just over the water in Kerry. Was there any kind of nuances or differences, say, between the Donegal Islanders and the Irish he spoke on the mainland or anything?
Not a lot. Now, Tory Island would be different. Tory, you could spot slight differences. But they wouldn't have interacted with the mainlanders as much because they were cut off for long periods of time, for sometimes up to 4 months or 5 months. They just weren't making it to the mainland. Whereas the other islands, they were maybe 3 or 2, 4 miles off the coast. So it was easier. But it was still a tough life, especially in winter. And the reason that people left the islands initially was because there were no doctors. There were no nurses. Education was limited to primary school. If they wanted to go to secondary school, they had to go to the mainland. They had to go to boarding schools. And that is still the case.
Now, tell me, Padraig, as someone who teaches language here in New York and has done for a long time, and we can talk a little bit about that in case people are interested in finding out more about possibilities and opportunities to learn the language. But there's been this great tradition of literature out of the Blaskets. And at least to my mind, Micheál Ócháirne's book, and in fairness, we should acknowledge this memoir was co-written with his son-in-law, Gerry Hayes, who'll also be with us later tonight at the event. But there's something special about the literature that's come out of the Blaskets, Padraig. Am I right in saying that? And is there any way you can pinpoint what the origins of that tradition is? And is it self-perpetuating just because of the richness of some of the earlier work, or what do you think?
Well, I think they would have the art of storytelling. It was natural for them. Like Peg Sayers was a great storyteller. Even though she couldn't read or write, again, somebody else took down her memoir. And then you had Thomas O'Crihuan and Maurice O'Sullivan, who wrote Fihi Bliainic Fáis, 20 Years of Growing. And Micheál Ócháirne himself was writing articles for the Irish press while he lived in Dublin. Mm. Even though he had limited English, or very limited English, when he left the Great Blasket in 1937 to go to Dublin, and he became an apprentice bartender there. But it's fascinating that he was writing for the Irish Press, which was probably the top newspaper back then.
One of the things I noticed, Padraig, as well, in his memoir, From the Great Blasket to America, if anyone is interested in purchasing it, it's published by the Collins Press in Cork in Ireland, and probably the easiest way of getting it is to go on to their website, and I believe it's available on Amazon as well. And if you're coming tonight, we do hope to have signed copies of the memoir available as well. It is in the English language, so don't be put off if you don't have Cúpla Focal or any Irish at all. I don't know if you'd agree with me, Padraig, but what struck me in reading it was how the formation of the Irish language and the floweriness of the Irish language and the particular constructions of the Irish language, to me, they come through very strongly in the text of this memoir. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Because his English would be very much influenced by Irish. Because what happens is when you're brought up in one language and you change, let's say in your late teens or early 20s, you're definitely going to have influences because you're thinking in your native language still. And you will get expressions like, very common expression would be, I'm after doing it, I'm after seeing it. Now, to the average American, that they don't understand that. They think it's that you intend to do it, but in fact, you had just done it.
Mm. And that's coming from a direct correlation with the Irish.
Tarish, Tame Inye, Dol, Gujian Shapa. So on.
It's fascinating when you actually see it in that way, how strong it is that it comes through, because it, presumably it went through editing. He worked on it with his son-in-law, who's not an Irish language speaker at all. He's of Irish descent, but he wouldn't have had that linguistic background as well. But it was so pervasive in how he thought and wrote that still came through.
It's a very important book from the social history point of view, because there is no other book written by an islander from that period that I'm aware of, and that is in print at this time.
Right. So what's also interesting, I think, as well, is the sense you get from it, Padraig, of that Irish-speaking community in Springfield. Can you tell me a little bit about what you know of the community that has been in Springfield, I guess, over 50 or 60 years or more?
Yes. It's mainly made up of islanders, and I believe there's a lot of Connemara people there also. But that was where the Kerry Islanders went in general. Muncher and the Line, as they called themselves. Now, an interesting thing about Donegal Island immigrants, for example, from Aranmore, they ended up going to Chicago and ended up going into mining in particular, or probably digging to make a subway and stuff like that. So they went into high-paying jobs. For example, Aranmore Islanders are still known as Tunnel Tigers, even in London. And they were known for that back in the day. Now, going back to the Great Blasket, obviously the oral tradition was very much alive there. And we see that in Peg Sayers, in her memoir. Micheál Ócárna refers... He knew Peg Sayers, but he says in his book that she spoke very slowly. But that's how it was years ago. They had this tradition, especially if they were storytellers. They wanted to be understood. And if you want to be understood, you have to speak clearly and slowly.
Yeah, and I asked him about that, Padraig, when I had the pleasure of sitting down and interviewing Micheál a couple of months ago. I told him that I was worried before I'd interviewed him I wouldn't be able to keep up with his Irish, because some of the Kerry Irish can be very quick on the tongue. And one of the remarks he made on it, and you probably agree, and the point you've just made to some extent, is that they weren't in much of a hurry on the island, right. So they weren't rushing out the language in a way that...
Exactly. And all they had to do in winter and long winter nights was to tell stories. So it was a very important social gathering, would be to go to hear somebody tell a story. And these stories have been passed down in the oral tradition over generations.
I'm really excited, Padraig, that we have the opportunity in New York City. I know Micheál is pretty well known in and around Springfield and the Boston area, etc. But as far as I know, at least in recent times, it's a fairly unique opportunity to hear someone. He's going to be 94 years of age in a few weeks' time. And it's just fantastic to have the opportunity. And I think you'll agree it was important for us to keep this as an in-Irish event, Lán Ghaeilge, just so that people would have the opportunity to really hear his language uncorrupted and without the need for translation necessarily.
Absolutely. And even if you don't understand Irish, you will enjoy listening to him, and it is something very special, and I'm looking forward to meeting him later this evening.
This conversation that we're having now, Padraig, this isn't it for the semester indeed, folks. One of our very popular events towards the end of the semester, this year it's on Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m, is Ornail na Nollag. Can you tell me a little bit about that, Padraig? What is that event?
Okay, basically it's an evening of traditional Irish song in Irish. Not as much Seanós, more traditional songs in Irish. Catchy songs that you would all know, like naturally Ó Róiseadh na Hábhála would be one, but We have a repertoire of about 40 songs, and they're presented by the Glucksman Ireland House folk group, and we have about 20 members at this point, and some of them are extremely talented. We have piano players, traditional instruments, the fiddle, tin whistle, the harp, all made up of New York University students, both undergrads and graduate students. We have these RNLs twice a year. We have them in May or end of April and then towards Christmas, RNL na nollag. We also have traditional song workshops in the language at various times throughout the semester.
For people who are interested in the language and who aren't graduate or undergraduate students with us here at NYU, you provide a fantastic resource in terms of people being able to come in the evening and take classes.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes, well, we provide classes at four levels. There's a class for absolute beginners, and then it goes up, right up three other levels to the advanced level. At the advanced level, the whole class will be conducted through Irish. We also read novels or memoirs. For example, at the moment we are reading Mickey McGowan, who I mentioned earlier, Rochamore an Thiel, which was translated as The Hard Road to Klondike, a fascinating book also, but 30 years earlier than Micheál O'Carroll's story. So it's different.
Right.
So
how do you find out about those classes?
You can contact me directly at po2@nyu.edu, or you can go onto the website and you will get information there, either to call or to email me. The classes start next week. We have intermediate classes on Tuesday, two classes, and then on Wednesday we have advanced class at 6:15, and then at 7:45 we have the beginners class.
So next week is the week of Monday, September 15th, right?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And they'll run through right until about mid-December?
Early December.
Yeah,
it's 10 sessions.
Okay.
10 sessions. And these classes are open to the public, and they are very reasonable. So if you want more details, get in touch with me.
That's great, Padraig. Well, listen, hopefully later on in the semester, we'll have an opportunity to sit down with you again and find out more about what's going on and maybe tell us a little bit about your Shan Nós workshops, and maybe we can fill in people a little bit more on some of that stuff. Gurb míle maith agat, and good luck this evening in your interview with Micheál O'Carroll. It's a great honour to have you and he sit down, and we're looking forward to that.
Gurb míle agat, thank you very much.
Earlier on, I mentioned that Dr. Gerard McAtasney, the author of the newly published book, The Dead Buried by the Dying, The Great Famine in Leitrim, would be coming in to have a chat to us about his remarkable in-depth study of the Great Famine in County Leitrim, depicting the extent of the catastrophe at a local level. I'm delighted to have Gerard with us here at Glucksman Ireland House. I believe probably his first visit to us here at Washington Square Mews. And I'm delighted that his visit to New York over the last 10 days or so has been so fruitful in terms of making the people in the New York and tri-state area aware of this great contribution to studies in the famine. Welcome, Gerard, and thank you for sitting down with us today.
Thank you very much indeed. Pleasure to be here.
Now, Gerard, this is fantastic, and I'd like you to maybe start off by talking a little bit about, you know, anyone who knows anything about the history of the Irish famine knows how important these more localised studies of the famine are. I mean, we know the grand sweeps of, in terms of patterns and things like that, the generalisations, Skibbereen jumps to mind. What did your research show about Leitrim in terms of how it fits into the generalities, or what's particular about it?
Well, I think the thing about local studies is that you can make generalizations on a national level, but there are some aspects of the famine decade that just can't be explained. And the local studies can sort of shine a light on those. For example, in Leitrim, just off the top of my head, there were a number of townlands in the county that actually experienced population growth between 1841 and 1851. Now the vast majority did experience a loss, but you know, and it's trying to get down quite literally into the grassroots to understand why that may have happened in certain townlands, and then you know, even dealing within a county itself, you know, the population loss for Leitrim was 28%, around about 43,000 over the decade, but then when you break that down into the baronies, you find that the barony of Mull had a loss of 38%, which is one of the highest in the region. And then if you break it down into parishes, you find that the parish of Annaduff had a loss of 47.8%. So the further you break it down, then the more difficult it becomes to make generalizations.
Right.
So that's what local studies offer. And in terms of this book, it's the first book to actually use the vast resource of the Society of Friends. They have a Society of Friends Relief of Distress Papers in Dublin, and they've never been used before, simply because the local histories that were published to mark the sequicentenary in the late 1990s were rushed out to a large extent, so that every area you could say, well, at least we marked the 150th anniversary of the famine. And people did, what researchers did was they used the Poor Law Union records, and they also used the British Relief Commission papers. The problem with the Relief Commission papers is that they end in May of 1847, because the British said the famine was over in 1847, whereas the Society of Friends papers start in 1846 and continue, certainly in the case of Leitrim, into early 1850. So you've got a correspondence going on between various individuals within the county, demonstrating that the famine was much deeper than thought and also had a greater longevity than previously thought.
And many of our listeners today, Gerard, would be particularly interested in the kind of diasporic aspect of the famine, or the migration, the knock-on effects in terms of migration. Are there any themes that spring to mind on those specific topics?
Yeah, well, it was just taken for granted that people moved to America. There are just throwaway comments. I mean, a landlord's agent based around the Clune area in South Leitrim, he talks about having little pity for the tenants and said how they hadn't paid any rent for the previous 5 years, and that, you know, they had bribed the bailiff to go off to America. Just a throwaway comment. There's also a poem that was published in the Roscommon and Leitrim Gazette in 1850, was I've actually used in the book. It's a parody of the landlord's problem. It's called the Emigrating Tenant's Address, where the tenant who's moving is making fun of the landlord, and he says, "It's off to Yankee land I go." You know, so everybody was heading. I came across a letter from 1850 from Leganummer, again in the Clune area, from the Flood family, and they're writing and saying, you know, the brother's in America along with one of the sisters, and he's saying, "I've sent the money home for the other sister to come. Why isn't she here? You know, everybody's over here." Mm-hmm. So this sibling migration becomes very, very strong from about 1849-50, and what you tended to find was that people came over to an area where they felt secure with people from the same area themselves, from the Clune area or Ross Inver, Kinloch, or whatever it would be, and settled. And then the first thing was to get a job, earn enough money, and then send the money home so that another member of the family could come over.
You mentioned there earlier, before we sat down more formally, that there were patterns of migration from Leitrim to Dundee. Can you talk a little bit about that, or any other examples of specific townland or parish migration to places?
I mean, it's a case of really exploiting the sources that are available to us. As I've mentioned, the Society of Friends, the Irish Relief Association. So there you're looking at actually at correspondence. But there's great statistical information as well. You've got the 1841, 51 and 61 census. And what I did was evaluate the 1851 census for Britain. So you have the detailed records of the people who were moving from Leitrim to England and also to Scotland. So you can break it down by gender, by age, and also by area. And you find that the vast majority of people from Leitrim were heading to the Lancashire Mills in England, so they were heading to Manchester and Liverpool, both men and women, mostly in the age group of 20 to 40. And then in Scotland, you would have thought they'd be heading to Glasgow, because Glasgow is supposed to be a great magnet for the Irish Catholics, but actually they were heading further east to Dundee. So there seems to be a pattern of people moving further into areas where Leitrim people have already been established, in areas like Dundee, which is probably a forgotten part of the history at this stage. You know.
What was the most surprising, or was there anything, Gerard, in terms of your knowledge of the famine prior to this research project and culminating in the book, that totally undermined your interpretation of the Great Irish Famine in Ireland or in Leitrim more specifically?
I mean, there's so many aspects to it. It's a very, very detailed work on a specific Irish county, and that really hasn't been done before. I mean, I've been researching this on and off for 15 years, And I suppose, I mean, I've never gone into it with a particular perspective because, you know, you let the sources speak and you're guided by the sources. For example, the immigration records, I mean, I wasn't expecting to find people going to Dundee. You went for the, you know, preconception. As I say, they went to the west of Scotland. But I think looking at the book overall, the interesting perspective is that the contemporary newspaper accounts of the time are damning in their assessment of the British relief efforts. I think that's very, very important because the claims have been made by the revisionist school, particularly in the 1980s, that there were no contemporary accounts, for example, calling for the closure of the ports. Now, that is obviously, without sounding disparaging, that obviously comes from people who've never opened a contemporary newspaper from 1845 to 1852 or 3. The impartial reporter really takes to task the British government over the census of 1851 and says that it's a gross underestimate. In fact, one of the things you, relating to your earlier question, one of the things I found particularly interesting was that if we look at the work of, you know, established and recognised experts, economic historians like Cormac O'Grada, they'll say the population increase was actually much reduced from 1841 onwards. So you had a population increase from 1821, 31, 31, 41. 41 onwards it was decreasing. My analysis using the records, and they are sparse, Catholic records for County Leitrim where the population was 89% Catholic according to the 1834 religious census. So you look at 90% of the population really, and the records are pretty sparse, Catholic records are, due to the penal laws and that. But of the half a dozen or so churches which are scattered throughout the county, they show that marriages and baptisms were actually increasing in some areas, up right up until 1846. So the knock-on effect, the corollary, is that the 1841 census figure for Leitrim, for example, of just over 155,000, is a gross underestimate, possibly by as much as 10,000. You know, so you've got lives there that have never existed, they've never been recorded because they weren't part of the census returns. You know, so your population loss in Leitrim, far from being 43,000, could be as much as 60,000. We just don't know.
Could you hazard a guess, Jared, as to what is the explanation for those demographics that seem to truncate or, you know, undermine our general perception of population loss? Was it that localised in terms of the starvation or the impact of the famine? Is that all you're looking at there?
My brother-in-law lives in Clune, and I was speaking to his father, and he said he's from Ahawillan, just outside Ballinamore, and he was saying that, you know, there was a tradition that there was a river between two townlands, and that and you could actually bend down in this river and catch fish. And it may well have been something as simple as that which ensured that the population of one townland wasn't impacted upon to the same extent as other townlands. You know, there are some things, and I write in the book, that they're just, you know, unless you have a really local knowledge, and it would need to be contemporary, you just can't explain it. I mean, there were three townlands in the county between 1841 and 1861 which didn't lose any population. So there are about 1,500 townlands. And after analysis of them, there are only three which didn't lose any population. And of those three, only one had the same in terms of male and female. And that was the townland of Doreen, south in Kishkerrigan area, Ahacashel. Miles Lee, and looking at the Griffiths valuation for Miles Lee and his land, it transpires that his land was of a better quality than the people in the area. Also, he seems to have had a business, because in subsequent years, the Lees were known for having a post office and that. So he may well have been able to have supported his family despite the high prices for corn and potatoes and that, because he had that extra income. So it's just small things like that that made the big difference.
Did you come across any instances of landlords helping out people and things like that, or being more, you know, philanthropic in terms of their care of people on their land and things?
The landlord question is interesting, and it's dictated by the sources available. Interestingly, two of the major landlord papers for the period are actually in the Put of Records office in Belfast. And so I analysed the records of three landlords, one who's well known, Lord Leitrim, and he has actually, in the National Library in Dublin, there's an account book which details the transactions on his estate every single day from about 1830 to 1850. It's a huge ledger, and it tells you who was working, what they were working at, and how much they were paid. But interestingly, it also details people who were fined for not doing work properly. But what I found particularly interesting was that there were occasions when people were sick that he was saying, I'm going to pay you anyway for the week. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, in February 1847, he was fining people a week's wages for not carrying out work properly. For example, not going to the market or not going to the fair or being drunk at the fair. So in the midst of this, when people were starving, he was still fining people. There are also in the Clune area, and Clune was an extremely lively area, and to be euphemistic about it, there was a lot going on. Landlords' agents were being attacked, landlords' houses, etc., were being attacked over a 20, 30 year period. But there, the landlords were much less understanding, and they were quite happy to evict any number of families off the land. The Keppel estate in round parts of Kiltohart Parish and Clune as well. The landlord is writing to his agent, who's living in Drumsna, and saying, right, well, the ordinary people aren't going to suffer. It's going to be the middleman who's going to suffer here. If the ordinary people can't pay their rent, then the person I want to get rid of is the middleman, and we'll help the poor people. You know, so it doesn't fit the stereotype. There are three different approaches there to what was actually happening. What the Society of Friends paper is showing, and back to that again, is that the local landed gentry, the Slacks of Annadale, the Johnsons of Kinloch, the Kirkwoods of Carrick and Shannon, they owned what we would regard now as very grand houses, but by landlord standards at the time, they were minor gentry. Without them, thousands more would have died, because they set up their own private relief funds. And just to give you an idea of the extent of the importance of those, the officially sponsored British government relief agencies established in October 1846 and worked until about May 47, there were 18 of those in the county. The Society of Friends funded a further 55 in the county, supporting anything from a couple of dozen local people to a couple of thousand. And they would have stepped in at times when the public works were stopped by the British government in order to bring in the Soup Kitchen Act in February, March 1847, and there was a hiatus. And the danger is, when you're reading history from today back, you make assumptions based on, well, this should have happened, they should have seen this. But there was a hiatus, so that on the ground then you would have had maybe a month, 6 weeks, where the workers were being laid off and the new act hadn't actually been implemented. What happened in the meantime? Well, the Society of Friends stepped in, and they helped people who otherwise would have starved. There's one example of a priest who's saying, you know, the men on the public works have not been paid for 16 days. Now, that was a minor, would have been seen as a minor clerical error at government level. You know, some secretary hadn't done his paperwork properly, would have received a rap on the wrist. As the local priest, Father McHugh in Killargy, says, you know, these people were starving. We had to set up a relief committee to help them. So that was the reality.
Quite literally starving.
Quite literally starving. I mean, there are, you know, and Brandon McShibney has commented on what he termed the demi-monde in this period, this sort of other world that people don't talk about, whether it be, as he commented on, you know, a couple of young boys having their throats slit down in the south of the country because this man wanted meal off and whatever. And in Leitrim, you know, you've got a couple of examples, and there's sort of moral dilemmas where, you know, young James Foley, 14-year-old from Killinumry, they sent to the Manor Hamilton workhouse because he's suffering from fever. He goes to the fever hospital then. 3 days later, he arrives home, but the father won't let him into the house. It's January, it's freezing cold. The father's got other children there. He won't let him in because he's afraid of them all contracting fever. So the son is left outside and dies of exposure, frozen to death. The other one, just outside Drumshambo, again in the south of the county this time, and men are working on the public works. Now, these people are working in the freezing cold, they're earning a couple of pence a day, but they see this woman lying in a ditch with her dead daughter beside her. So they decide to raise some money to give to her to buy a coffin for the daughter. They come back in a couple of days, no coffin's there, the daughter's still there. The mother has gone and bought food. Meanwhile, half the daughter's body's been eaten by rats. And, you know, it's one of those where people have a sharp intake of breath when they hear that, and you sort of say, but by that stage, the woman's by herself with the daughter, that tells you a lot. Where's the husband? Has he deserted her so that she can get entry into the workhouse? Because she would be destitute. Men did that. Has he gone off to look for work in England or Scotland? Or has he died and other children died? Because there weren't too many families who had just the one child. So has this woman, in effect, has she become immune to death? And is it that desperate scramble for existence, for life, that, right, a coffin's no good for my daughter, she's dead, I need food. Mm-hmm. And it's those sort of moral dilemmas that it throws up. And you find that at the local level then, you know. So that's what I find fascinating, is getting down to the townland level, where you've got, especially in the Society of Friends papers, you've got lists of hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe running into thousands for the county, who are receiving clothes, who are receiving food. You know, you've got a list of people that, I mean, on the outdoor relief under the British government system of poor law from 1847 onwards, October 1847, people were they weren't entitled to. They had to prove themselves destitute. They received outdoor relief, and that relief amounted to £7 of meal a week for an adult. you know, just about able to survive. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and what I've found over here in New York, and obviously I find it when I'm back in Leitrim in a couple of weeks, is that, you know, once you pinpoint a townland, there are still families who live in those townlands today, and it really hits home with people that, you know, that would have been a relative of mine or somebody who lived up the road or whatever. So it's very, very strong from that perspective.
It's a fascinating insight, Gerard, and thank you for coming in today to tell us about it. Tell us the name of the book again, and tell people here in the United States and in New York, what's the best way for them to purchase this book?
The book is called The Dead Buried by the Dying, The Great Famine in Leitrim. It's published by Merrion Press, an imprint of Irish Academic Press. They've got a website, which is www.iap, the publisher is Connor Graham, and that's where you get it through. I don't think they do it through Barnes and Noble, and I think you just have to go on the website.
Great. Thanks again, Gerard, for coming in today.
Pleasure. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
We've welcomed a large number of new students into our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies this fall, and we're delighted to be able to energise their work and give them inspiration by allowing people have an opportunity to hear from one of our MA alums, Kate Feary, who went through the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies in recent years, has come in to talk to us today about her journey through the programme and how it has led to her role as the archivist for the Archdiocese of New York. It's a wonderful opportunity to hear how her journey through the programme has led to what she does today. Welcome, Kate. It's great to talk to you today.
Thanks, Miriam.
Can you just bring us back a little bit and let us have a sense of what brought you to a Master's in Irish and Irish American Studies? What was the impetus for that?
Well, I was working at a publishing company, and I was really interested in expanding my personal interest in history and New York City. I grew up outside of New York, and my dad was really active in the Offaly County Association and always brought us to events as children, the annual masses, the St. Patrick's Day Parade, events like that. So it had always been a strong part of my family and personal life, and this program seemed to give me the ability to continue a knowledge of the Irish American community in New York and combine it with the true professional history.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, Kate, your grandparents were all born in Ireland?
Yes, all my father's parents were born in Ireland, and they were 1920s immigrants. My dad grew up in the Bronx, and his dad was very active in the New York GAA, and so my dad and his brothers continued that.
In terms of hearing, I assume then, your father talking about growing up in the Bronx and things like that, can you tell me a little bit about those stories that are the strongest memories you have of your interpretation of your father's childhood?
So my dad grew up in the Highbridge neighborhood of the Bronx, which had a very strong Irish presence. And throughout my life, I was baptized at the church in Highbridge, Sacred Heart. And my dad has continued working and volunteering for the parish, regardless of where he lived. And he's always been very active down there and always had stories about growing up in the neighborhood. And, you know, he attended Manhattan Prep with a lot of other kids from the neighborhood and just had a very strong connection, even though his family ultimately ended up moving further up in the Bronx.
What was it in particular about NYU, Kate, and Luxman Ireland House? What was the attraction in terms of an Irish Studies program here?
The attraction was the New York City location and really the focus on the Irish history and literature combination to really expand, you know, my horizons. I was familiar with the New York Irish community, but not as much with Irish literature, Irish American literature, or Irish history itself. So I really got to expand those areas of knowledge.
In the course of your journey through the program, you must have undertaken some research for papers and or theses. Can you tell us a little bit about your most prominent, you know, biggest experiences in that regard?
Well, one of my earliest papers that really got me focused on the history side of things was working with Marion Casey on a paper about the New York City draft riots. They have a very strong image in the historical story of New York City, and Marion helped me examine that from a different perspective, and I was able to use a lot of primary source resources. I used the district attorney records at the municipal archives, as well as accounts of the draft riots written at the time and later, to combine them into a new view of the Irish participation in those riots.
And what was that view that you shed a light on, Kate, in the course of that research?
Well, the popular image seemed to be sort of the Gangs of New York image, you know, these Irish immigrant hoodlums spilling out of the notorious Five Points neighborhood and really wreaking havoc on the city. And, you know, research kind of showed that while the destruction was significant, it was really a very small minority of the participants that were active in the more destructive events of the time. And they didn't really come from the Five Points at all. They came from different parts of the city and had sort of a different motivation going into the riots than has been popularly portrayed.
And so were they kind of drafted in, Kate, then? Or?
It sort of seemed to be, you know, there was a lot of looting going on. A lot of these people were very poor, and it sort of seemed to be more crimes of opportunity than any crimes of true anger or maliciousness. A lot of the items that were taken, especially in the, as shown in the district attorney records, were more day-to-day things that you would need just to survive, a dress, a pair of shoes. And there was a lot of differences in the official record and what people were saying and how the event was portrayed later.
So what was it about that? Was it the kind of thrill of the primary sources that got you hooked? Or?
It was. It was really being able to delve into those records myself from 1863.
I guess, you know, the records were probably going into 64 as well.
Right. The district attorney cases kind of carried over into the next year. And it was surprising the number of cases that weren't ever taken any further because of lack of evidence and other, you know, a lot of the charges were ultimately dropped against people that were accused of participating. But it was really being able to sort of look at the accounts that had been written and contrast them with these official records that have survived to this day that really got me hooked on the history side of things.
That was a research paper, Kate. That wasn't even your dissertation as such, your thesis for the program?
Right. That was just a paper for a class I took one semester.
And then what did you do your master's thesis research on?
My thesis research was sort of a demographic profile of the Highbridge neighborhood in the Bronx, where my dad did grow up and spend a lot of time. I got interested in that. You know, my dad always has stories about growing up in that neighborhood, and I did oral history interviews with other people that had also grown up there. And what was interesting was how many of the Irish residents portrayed the neighborhood as, you know, 100% Irish or 90% Irish. And looking back at census records from the time period, the neighborhood was majority Jewish. And the Irish, you know, while a big part of the population, were in no way the majority. And so I was trying to explore what about the Irish experience living in a neighborhood like Highbridge made people that had grown up there remember the neighborhood as being so significantly Irish.
Have you any conclusions as to why that was the case, Kate?
A big part to me, I found, was the church and the significance of the church, the significance of the church in the lives of the Irish residents of the neighborhood. The church at the time, I was looking, you know, from the 1920s through the late 60s, the church was really this all-encompassing institution. It had the church you went to on Sunday, the school children went to every day. It had dances, bingo, events, clubs. It was really an everyday part of people's lives. It was very different from the way the church is now, you know, with maybe some CYO sports and math on Sundays. It was when the church was renovated and the school building was renovated in the 40s and 50s, they built a room that allowed people in to watch films. There was a playground on the roof. They held dances. During World War II, it was very active in keeping tabs on people from the neighborhood that were serving overseas and published a pamphlet that should be sent overseas to give different residents updates on other people that they may have known from the neighborhood that might have been serving in a different part. It really worked to sort of establish this very, very strong ties between the neighborhood, the residents, and the church.
Would you think, and I don't know whether your research allowed you to touch on that, would you guess or speculate as to the same sense of community then in the Jewish community through their institutions?
I didn't really touch on that as much, but it seems like the Jewish community, there were a couple of synagogues within walking distance of the neighborhood, so it wasn't this sort of main institution. And also a lot of the Jewish children attended public schools, so there wasn't that tie from childhood to the neighborhood church.
It's fascinating when you think about it. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kate. Was part of that research published? Did you go on to publish that?
In the New York Irish History Roundtable Journal, yes.
Okay. So you finished your Master's in Irish and Irish American Studies in 2011, 12, was it?
Nine.
Oh, it's that long ago. So then what was the next move for you?
The next move for me was I actually went on to get a certification in archiving, also from New York University through the History Department. I used so many primary source resources, both for my thesis and for other projects that I did, and I really enjoyed the process of discovery and also the information that you get from primary source resources. It's not diluted through someone else's words or someone else's point of view, and I really enjoyed that. And so the archival certification program is actually part of the Master's in Archives and Public History that New York University offers, and it was a really great experience.
So it sounds like it was a great complement to what you had done in the Master's in Irish and Irish American Studies.
It really was, and I was able to do an internship with the Archives of Irish America also here at New York University, so it really tied my two interests together.
At that point, you were considering abandoning publishing as a career?
I was. I never really looked at publishing as a long-term career option for me, so I was able to have it as a support while I was going through all this schooling and then move on from it.
How has your experience of NYU, then more generally the History Department and the Luxman Ireland House, how has that translated into what you do today?
Well, I'm currently the archival manager for the Archives of the Archdiocese of New York. The Catholic Church in New York has really strong ties with the Irish community, both here and over in Ireland. And so I've been able to translate my archival skills and my knowledge of Catholic and Irish New York into questions that come up on the job all the time.
Is the journey you took through this world, Kate, something you enjoyed and would do again?
Oh, absolutely. I really enjoyed everything I learned. And also the program at Ireland House really offers such great opportunities to interact with other scholars and other speakers that come in, both for the master's program and for the general public program, are really great in terms of expanding knowledge. And just the community here is very supportive and active.
This is great, Kate. It's lovely to have listened to your journey through the whole world of a Master's in Irish and Irish American Studies. And maybe another day you'll come back and tell us a little bit more about the jewels buried in the archives and the Archdiocese.
Sure, anytime.
Thanks, Kate. Lovely talking to you today.
You too, Miriam.
We are coming towards the end of the program for this week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu and our telephone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to www.irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, stay with us until noon. We hope to see you at our events here at Luxman Ireland House on Thursday the 18th and on Friday the 19th. I mentioned those events earlier, and if you do want any more information, do consult our website. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.